2-3-1.
Did you say 2-3-1?
You know, here's the thing. So y'all heard that click, and I'm going to leave it in the edit so that you understand what's happening here. I want to advise folks, Brooke Lottie, Classic Lottie, I've been sipping on it consistently since we started, and I forgot a very key piece of information about it. It is bottled at 50%, 100 proof. So it is.
Oh, wow.
It's a little bit more. Normally, I think, Patrick, you're Glenfiddich. I think it's bottled at 43%. So I'm going to 100% gone. Give myself a pass on that at this point.
That should be the new tagline. So strong, it'll make you count wrong.
So strong, it'll make you count wrong. I like it.
Yeah, that's good.
Hey everybody, you're listening to the Drunken UX Podcast. Thanks for joining us this evening. This is episode number 60, where we will be talking about UX career paths and different specialties within the sphere of user experience. We're joined this evening by special guest Patrick. I'm not even drinking it, and I can't get the words out of my mouth. Patrick Branigan.
Patrick Pranigan.
I'm sorry, Patrick, yeah. But every time I read your name, I also think about what's the starship captain on Futurama?
Stewart? Oh.
Zap
Branigan, yeah.
Isn't that? Yeah, oh. I get that a lot. Yep.
Yeah. Every time I say it, I think about it. Folks, if you are enjoying the Drunken UX Podcast, be sure to stop by our friends in the interactive mapping world over at NewCloud. You can check them out at newcloud.com/drunkenUX. Be sure to throw the /drunkenUX on there so that they know that you got there because you were listening to us. We would appreciate it, and they would love to sell you a map, maybe, or an illustration. Let's see. What else? I am your host, Michael Veenan.
I'm your other host, Aaron Hill. How you doing, Michael?
Not too bad. I'm still cooped up in the house, but I've been trying to get out and get some fresh air whenever possible.
Yeah, I had a walk today. That was nice.
Folks, if you want to connect with us, if you are out there and you're cooped up and looking for somebody to chat with, you can find us on Twitter or Facebook at /drunkenUX. You can also hit us on Instagram at /drunkenUXpodcast. If you want to chat with us, there is a change. You can still use our old URL that we plugged in other episodes, but use drunkenux.com/discord. We are moving from Slack to Discord. There are a number of reasons for that change, none of which are really important to anybody but us. But we will be transitioning over to Discord. So feel free to use the old link if you hear that. It will just refer you to Discord. So don't be confused if you do /Slack and it sends you to a different application invite. But Aaron, what are you drinking tonight, man?
I'm going basic. I got a Svedka and tonic tonight. Yeah, it's just like this super simple. Like, I don't want to say it's technically alcohol. I mean, because it's good. Like, it's flavorless vodka, like, you know. And then you add the flavor to it. I like it because it's cheap and it's like good enough.
Yeah. Hey, there's nothing to knock by finding something that you like that doesn't break the bank. I'm not going to, never going to throw shade. I drink Monkey Shoulder and that's a $32 bottle of scotch. And
that wasn't technically liquor. What was the one that was technically alcohol?
Oh, you know, I don't know what
rocks.
Started that
rocks.
Now. Oh, yeah. Rocks. So ironically, though, so on the rocks, technically alcohol, technically scotch, comes from a distillery called Brooke Lottie. Now, on the rocks, I don't think you can get it anymore. I don't think they make it anymore because Brooke Lottie is, I kind of refer to them as a boutique scotch distiller. They like doing like limited runs or specialty runs of things. They generally don't have age statements on anything because of the way they blend their scotch. But I am drinking a Brooke Lottie tonight. I'm drinking the Classic Lottie. So it's the one last episode I had you choose for me, the Four Roses or the Brooke Lottie. I had Four Roses then, so I'm having the Brooke Lottie tonight. It's the Classic Lottie. It's very nice. It's an Isla Scotch. Normally, Isla Scotch is very smoky, very peaty. The Classic Lottie is an unpeated Isla Scotch, so it doesn't have that like punch you in the face kind of flavor. It's actually on the nose. It's very like a sort of dry grass, morning grass kind of smell, grainy kind of smelling, but it's got an oily slightly sweet palate to it. You get a little, there is a tiny bit of like salt, but there's this briny, because it is still an island-based scotch, so you get a sort of brininess that comes out in it that's kind of nice. So if you think about that interplay between salt and sweet a little bit, is definitely what you what you get out of it. And
I'll have to look for salt the next time I have it.
Yeah.
I've never even heard of that.
It's, well, just one of many. And Burke Lottie has been really hit or miss for me, but I do like the Classic Lottie. It's one that I am willing to go ahead. And the bottle is just very pretty. It's a bright green.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Green boy. Patrick, cool. I think you're joining me on the trip to Scotland, right?
Yeah, I'm a beer guy myself, so this is a special occasion. I am drinking Valley of the Deer, which I think it's Valley of the Deer, in Scottish Gaelic, Glenfiddich, 15-year. I'm enjoying that for the first time in quite some time. Like I said, not typical drink of mine, but
the 15 is good. The 18 is pretty incredible, though a little pricey. The 21 is one of my all-time favorites. It's a Speyside Scotch. It's sweet. The 21, the Gran Reserva, is aged in rum casks, similar to the Balvenie 14. Beautiful brown sugar kind of flavor to it.
The Doublewood is still my favorite.
All my friends stopped getting married. I ran out of marriages to go to, so I have. That's where I would drink my scotch usually. Weddings.
The thing I really like about Glenfiddich, even at like the 12 is even really good, and I think really outperforms, say, Glenlivet 12. You'll run into a lot. Both Speysides. Glenlivet 12 has very little flavor to it for me, but Glenfiddich at a 12-year is actually still really good too, and very affordable. I think $35, maybe $40.
Yeah, I think it's usually, that would be usually, if I were to buy a bottle, what I would get. This was a gift from a friend of mine from New York for my birthday a couple of years ago, so it's still running strong.
So this week we are talking all about UX roles and job titles and specialties and skills and all of this, to help you kind of understand when we talk about user experience, that's a huge bucket of information. And so it's way too big for me. It's way too big for Aaron, at least by ourselves. So we brought in Patrick. I did it again. Why am I inserting extra R's?
It's okay. This is the only time you've done this.
I'd say I feel bad about that, but the number of times people have mispronounced my last name, you know?
Yeah, no, I'm fine. It's a lot of letters. I think it's, what, 7 and 7? That's, it's 14 or so. Yeah.
He is a product designer at a little company that I have a tiny bit of familiarity with called Aquint.
Oh, I think I've heard of them before.
Yeah, Patrick and I are coworkers, as it turns out, but we have a lot of overlap in some of the stuff we do. I am a front-end developer, but he is one of our product designers and is heavily involved in both, you know, design and interaction design and visual design and all the things for the most part, which we will get into why these things overlap. Patrick, man, thanks for taking the time and sitting down with us. I know everything is crazy, but hey, we're all trapped at home, so we might as well be doing something with this time, right?
Yeah, no, I'm happy to be here. I am thriving in this moment of being trapped at home. I don't wish it upon anybody, obviously, especially with these circumstances. But yeah, I've been making do, and it's been quite productive, actually, for myself. But yeah, thanks for having me.
So I thought the best place to start with this discussion is let's talk first and foremost about sort of the skills that make up UX, because even I think it's worth kind of pointing out that even if you are a developer, like Aaron, you're a Ruby guy, you're a back end guy, you know, first and foremost, but the code you write still produces a user experience at some level.
Oh yeah, I've used to do like both sides a lot more.
And while we don't necessarily, we won't get into it in this episode, and we probably won't really talk about it much anywhere, but even things like writing, you know, things on the back end where you're doing, you know, database layer, abstraction layer type stuff, like latency in those exchanges translates to user experience problems because it means the front end is slow and the user doesn't know if it's broken or they should wait or whatever the case may be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the interconnectivity of it all is what I think makes user experience design hard to compartmentalize, right? I mean, some of those facets, you know, I'm sure you'll touch on them, but research, planning, creation, delivery, maintenance, and then you have front end, back end, as we're talking about, and the design aspect to it all. And that all connects into the marketing, and the marketing connects into the brand and identity, and it's a hefty term right now.
And then you get into things like CX, customer experience,
and all exactly.
That. You know, these are things that bolt on. And
as you know, this feels like, it feels like every time a scandal gets the word gate added to it, that's what this feels like.
Yeah.
everything gets an X on the end now.
We work as an industry by trying to carve out value, and we say, this is what I do, this is what I specialize in, this is what makes me valuable. And it's one of the reasons why you start getting all of these titles and all of this sort of fracturing of it. So people are just saying, this is my specialty. If I write a blog that gives it a name and it gets picked up on Reddit, then suddenly it's a thing for the next 6 months.
Yeah, that's kind of the blessing and the curse, or the double-edged sword, I guess, of the entire conversation, because I think the limelight on UX design began to shine heaviest in the era of us being able to self-publish whatever we want, and the accessibility to those pieces of content was easier and easier. And it's hard to define, but at the same time, we tend to be in complete control of how we want to define it. It's just a matter of understanding what that is.
Yeah. So I wrote a list here, and these are in no particular order, but one of the big ones to me is research and analytics. Because you got to know your users. You have to know things to do things. And there'll be an article, and I'll warn everybody, not warn, I will advise everybody. This episode is reference heavy, and I'm not going to stop to point out every one of them. The show notes are going to be ripe with a ton of links that describe all of these job titles, all of these roles, advice. So with research and analytics, of course, Nielsen Norman Group, as always, has a great article that has a breakdown of a bunch of tips for user research. Go check it out. It'll be in the show notes along with everything else that we'll be talking about. But research is a huge piece of this equation, I think, first and foremost.
Yep, totally is. And with that, I mean, I think research has an acute and particular connection to the ideas of UX design, user-centered design, design thinking, so on and so forth. And within that realm, there's just seemingly an infinite amount of methods and exercises that can be employed to garner a better understanding of what we hope is people that are using these products and services. And so research, that general area, I think, is indeed probably the first to become, I say compartmentalized, I don't mean that in a bad way, but the first to become a little bit more defined in these processes that these companies are creating internally to create better user experiences.
The second area, and I've joked about this elsewhere. I don't know if I've brought this up on this show, actually. I was a theater major in college.
What?
Which will come as a surprise to nobody who knows me.
I learned that tonight.
But I say that, I was actually a communication major. My degree is a communication degree. It just happens to have been emphasized within theater. But communication is another important piece of user experience. And not just how you are able to, you know, talk to the rest of your teams or get a point across to management. A big part of this comes back to listening. It's the whole reason it's called user experience is it's about the user. And so a person's ability to sit in a room with 10 people, ask a question, and then just absorb the feedback they're giving you and write it down and take note of it. That's hard for a lot of people.
Yep.
And also differentiate between one loud person and a bunch of very quiet people who may be mm-hmm. having a real problem. One loud person can make a trivial problem seem huge. A lot of quiet people may have a frustration that's not getting noticed.
That's 100% true, though. And it's not just if you expand that, you know, design researchers and design strategists have to be good at listening to users, but they also have to be good at listening to the companies, the businesses perspective,
yeah.
The marketing's perspective, the opportunistic spaces that are surfaced through these ideas that companies are coming up with. And yeah, it's hard. It is. It's hard to listen. And being traditionally as a designer, it's kind of a game of output. And I think it was a game of output. And I think what it's becoming more and more so of is a game of outcomes. And in order to really align everybody behind an outcome and a vision, there's the inherent necessity to understand multiple perspectives. And by understand, I mean listen to them and make sense of them.
Yeah.
You know what this makes you think of, Michael, since you and I both have a background in higher ed? It's when you're in a meeting about content for the homepage on the higher ed website, and the dean or chancellor or whoever your highest, high-ranking hippo is.
Hippo, yeah. highest paid person's opinion.
Right. They're really set on there being a carousel or making it pop or anything yep. like that. And you have the rank and file people who do the actual research on what students and its perspectives and everybody else wants, and very quiet.
Yeah.
Yep. And I think that ties into communication, as you mentioned, just generally the way in which you as a designer have to articulate in a synchronized fashion what these different perspectives mean to one another and find the unification or that thread of common understanding. Being able to explain that is difficult, and being able to explain it to everybody who you were listening to, those different perspectives, in a way that they all understand that is also quite difficult.
Yeah. Testing. Testing's a big part, of course. We've referred how many times there, and we need a clicker for that, right? How many times we refer to Rocket Surgery Made Easy? User testing and understanding how to create a test that does, you know, think of the scientific method, right? It's all about generating a hypothesis, creating a test, reviewing your results, and seeing, did you prove or disprove that hypothesis? And that's hard because a lot of people, especially when a hippo is involved and is saying, do this thing, they are inclined to tailor the test to produce the result that, you know, their CEO, their CMO, that whoever is driving a point, you know, they're inclined to kind of say, yeah, we'll just make the test so that it produces an outcome. And that's not good.
It's not uncommon for the outcomes of these tests to invalidate the ideas of these, as you're calling them, hippos or whoever, right? And then it's a challenge of, well, what findings or opportunities are we finding in this quote-unquote failure that could push the product or the service forward? That's, you know, constant learning and iteration, and that happens with tests.
Yeah.
So you were a theater major in college. I was a chemistry major, and one of the things that they always impressed on us in our lab classes was that science isn't about proving things, it's about disproving things. And so, like you mentioned, making a hypothesis, a good hypothesis is one that says, like, well, if this hypothesis wasn't true, this is what we would see. And you look for that negative outcome.
Yeah.
And then you look for a different negative outcome, and you keep looking for different ones, and you try to kind of slice it. You're carving that marble away from the statue. You're not molding the statue out of clay. Mm-hmm. And so you're just finding different pieces of chaff that, like, well, if this was chaff, this would happen. You cut that away.
To a degree, what we're fundamentally doing is experimenting. And I think that is much of what you're explaining too. And experiments, just generally, when money is on the line, that term in and of itself is scary, right? Yeah. So,
and I view testing too as something that, I'm sure we've said this kind of in the past, that, you know, What was true for your users when you started your application or your tool or your site may not be true 2 or 3 years later once they're familiar. Mm-hmm. You know, testing is always about challenging what you knew as much as what you want to know sometimes. And a lot of the times you can get very focused on testing the new thing, but not testing your old things. And so I think that's something else. And those are the kind of nuanced pieces of information that I think become very valuable when somebody says, yeah, oh yeah, we tested all of this stuff. And then we went back and we redid it 6 months later and we discovered that people had acclimated and were using shortcuts. And so we improved this experience further because they got used to it. You know, skeuomorphism is that classic comparison. We started with skeuomorphism because we needed people to understand mobile interfaces in a way that nobody had ever seen before. Apple comes out with this thing called the iPhone. Well, how do you change the volume? Let's give them a knob. Eventually, people figured that out. And so you could start to simplify it and reduce and shave away. And as Aaron, to your example, we chipped away the marble on that. And now skeuomorphism feels old and dated and not as sexy as far as that goes. And for those, we should probably say skeuomorphism is the practice of making, you know, designing something digitally to resemble something analog. So like I had said with iPhone, the idea of volume knobs.
Mm-hmm. A good example of that too is if you want to look into the research and testimonials behind it, but car consoles and dashboards, that's a Wild West realm right now of understanding a balance between skeuomorphism, reality, what I can actually touch, what I can't, in circumstances where I can't hear or I can't look or I can't see. So what am I doing? So you're seeing a really cool amalgamation of ideas happening in that space that have to do with several different quote unquote past trends, if you will, in design.
The implementation of skeuomorphism is what Donald Norman would call affordances. You're adapting, you're improving onboarding for a user by adapting something they know to something you're trying to teach them.
Yeah.
So the you know, the volume knob or the button that looks clickable because it has a drop shadow are ways to indicate or to kind of suggest this can be clicked on or this can be turned. And like you mentioned before, we don't really need to teach people that anymore.
Yeah.
But I think that, like, as long as the presentation of it isn't inhibiting it, like, you don't necessarily have to not do it. It's just not as necessary as it used to be.
One of the big areas of UX gets into prototyping and wireframing. And this one is, I think, pretty straightforward. It's exactly what it sounds like. The ability to create an interface and show it to somebody and see, does it work? Does it not work? Can you play with it? The idea behind prototyping and wireframing is no different, I think, in the digital space than it has been in any space for the last 100 years, for the most part. It just takes on a slightly different form for us.
Yeah, if anything, it's easier, right, for us to, we don't have to deal as much with physical materials, for example, but they still, you know, when you're creating an object, you're still prototyping multiple times to get that feedback.
Yeah. Writing an IA, because the words you use generate an experience. One of the other ones this folds into a little bit is accessibility and inclusive design. The reason I add these two together, the way, like, cognitive impairment and thinking about, like, reading level can be an accessibility issue. And understanding, you know, that a lot, I don't know what it is in the U.S. now, doesn't the average person read at, like, a ninth grade level in the U.S. or something? Like, frighteningly low, actually, is what I remember, and I'm going to give myself the affordance to be wrong in my memory on that. But writing an IA is information architecture. It's the structuring of your data, not just dealing with navigation and folders, but literally thinking about where do people go to find certain information about you and how is that structured.
Here's a pro tip. Don't organize your information architecture to directly reflect the architecture or the organization of your organization.
Yeah,
that's a good one.
I made I made that mistake a long time ago, early in my career.
Anybody who has worked in higher ed can, I think, sympathize with that because there is such, not just even hierarchy of the university from like a people standpoint, but you fight with the structure of, you know, you think, well, you have a college or you have the university. The university is composed of colleges. The colleges are composed of programs. But that kind of architecture stuff is where, again, you want the user to find what they're looking for. The last big one is interaction design. This is all of those little things, all of the little bits and pieces that start to bind together one interface to another interface, how a button behaves, what happens when you click on an element, down to what is the resulting page, you know, on the graph that you're looking at or the checkout of your shopping cart. Interaction design flows through all of, you know, all of that experience. We'll talk about journeys here in a second. The user journey, the customer journey, all revolves around interaction design and figuring out how to get people to do things and entice them to engage in your design without it being into that hostile pattern, and dark pattern territory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sort of like the before, the moment of, and the moment after is kind of how I've always thought of interaction design, both on, well, really on any level. It could be a button or it could be, I don't know, jumping down an inflatable slide that you pressed a button and it inflated itself. Who knows? But that's an interaction. That's probably like, maybe one of the hotter topics of the past 2 to 4 years from the perspective of anybody who isn't specifically and traditionally or historically involved in interaction design, is how designers could more fluidly and rapidly create and prototype interactions into these visual assets that they have. And that's where you're seeing the rise of a lot of software, ranging from, I don't know, Zeppelin's been around for a while, but you had Envision Studio, Figma, mm-hmm. the list goes on, so on and so forth.
So from there, the reason I brought Patrick in here, as a product designer,
the longest introduction ever.
Yeah. This is all an intro for Patrick to get to this point. Patrick has been working on a tool recently that we've got to look at internally that is very cool, that deals with figuring out how skills apply to a user and how different strengths in these different areas translate to what you are. And I want to be first and foremost, there's no finite list. As we've already said, this is like a growing industry. You will see titles come and go as the industry matures. These are going to be a lot of like the really common ones that you'll hear and what they do, basically.
Or where they fit, I think, is a good way to put it.
Right.
I think there's so many facets to experience design, and everybody with a particular, you know, T-depth specialty can fit into the world of UX. It's not so much, do you have the right skills to be a UX designer? It's more, what value do you bring that helps our experience process and team go to the next level?
And it's valuable, I think, right, to especially understand how broad this is when it comes to interacting with people who aren't in web development, interacting with marketers, interacting with management, and helping them understand why you may be good in a couple of these areas, why you're not good at all of them. Because we're going to go over a couple here. There's not a lot of overlap in some of these, even though they all tend to be considered UX. And that's okay. Like, that's, I think, the big part is I want to show you how broad this is so that you don't feel bad when you're not good at all of it, because you shouldn't be. Most of you will fall into the first category. Most people who get into this field will be the designer of one. I think
I think it's been discussed as the one who wears many or all of the hats, I think, in the past. And I, for one, have been in that position multiple times. And it's a very fruitful position because you learn a lot of skills that aren't directly related to your output as a designer.
Absolutely.
And that goes for both the craft, but also the business, right? What to do, when to do it, what not to do, and when not to do it. And so, yeah, it's the type of designer that has a general understanding of the UX design process and the methodologies involved in their entirety, and therefore can deliver enough value in any one area.
The phrase you'll hear in articles, I think, a lot is UX generalist.
Yeah. Yep.
And I correct me if I'm wrong. I'm going to speculate here as we talk through these. I feel like if you start as a designer of one or a generalist, and that's something you really get your foothold in, you will generally evolve into either like a UX design architect or a product designer. Because those roles, as we'll mention here, tend to oversee a lot. Like they understand sort of the full chain, the end-to-end process a lot better.
Yeah, I would speculate even further myself and say product design in some ways is what the conversation of UX design was a couple of years ago. It's just now becoming more and more relevant, I think, to businesses that there are specialties in UX design, and UX design is much more of a concert, if you will, rather than a skill set. And product design, to your point, I think is a specific position where, yeah, you're not going extraordinarily deep every day. I'll put it to you that way.
Right.
You do get into the weeds, you do get into the intricacies, but your primary value isn't so much tied to particular artifacts or particular spaces in teams. It's more of the perspective on orchestrating multiple things at one time with a unified and forward thinking vision.
What I've done, I've looked at Patrick's tool and I lifted most of these titles from that. And I think maybe one or two of them came from some other research.
And I've lifted some titles from places over the years that I've come across. So these are not by any means novel to me.
Starting with UX researcher. This one's easy, I think. A UX researcher is exactly what it sounds like. It's a data scientist, right? Like that's the sort of more generic term you would have heard applied to this 10 years ago.
I would take issue with it's exactly what it sounds like, because before we interviewed or we had a guest, Annie Lynn, on episode 56.
Yeah.
And she is a UX researcher, like that's her profession. And before that episode, I had a very different thought of what UX research was.
Fair enough.
And so I think the takeaway that I had was that UX researchers are looking into the future of where UX is heading rather than looking at what like the current practices are. I always thought UXR was like, you know, like, oh, someone who has read all of the NNG and all of the current usability books and is like a mastery of that, but that's not, it's like future.
I think both are true, quite frankly. Wildly. You know, researchers of in any field, you have your futurists, you have, you know, the people who are trying to predict where things will go, but you also have people who are trying to predict if, or not predict, but verify if what is happening now works. That's we've used this phrase, I think, before, trust but verify. That's what analytics is all about. Trust but verify, that's what the researcher does. They are the verify piece of that equation, whether that's verifying what you think is going to happen or what you think is happening. And so they're the people who know how to step in and run, I said earlier, that scientific method.
Just generally from my perspective, the UX designer as a researcher is one who tends to conduct qualitative and quantitative research in order to essentially inform decisions that are going to be made. But that requires the ability to look forward. It requires to predict opportunity for in a large part, and that is very forward thinking. And more importantly, their ability to help synthesize that research to inform the business and their future is really where their value from a high level excels.
Earlier we mentioned testing. This is where the testing starts to factor in, because they will take the test results and figure out how do these things answer. There, of course, will be an article specifically in the show notes that goes into, you know, what is a UX researcher and how do you become one. Annie's episode was episode 56, if you want to go back and check that one out.
Yeah.
I found that design researchers in UX teams, they are super valuable when it comes to understanding the uncertain the complex and the ambiguity that exists in a marketplace or the strategy and positioning of a product.
Mm-hmm. I've never known a researcher that didn't love being given the opportunity to say, go learn something.
Yeah, right.
Like,
right.
Not here's what we want to know. It's go out and figure something out. Like, that's where I've always found researchers really thrive, is just being given carte blanche and say, hey, go figure out where we're going. And
it's hard. It's like, it is very hard. I mean,
and they may be wrong.
Yeah, totally. The amount, it's hard on two fronts. One, there is a lot involved with research. As a designer involved in research, there is a lot to do. And two, once you get down from the tier of companies that are the Facebooks, the IBMs, the Oracles of the world, research is often the area that a company looks at and really needs to be proven to that it's valuable. And that's the difficulty, I think, for a lot of, you know, smaller companies that don't have the bandwidth or don't have the resource or don't have the monetary foundation to invest. And it's unfortunate, but I think it's becoming more and more prevalent throughout, you know, a range of industries and verticals.
Yeah. So from there, we translate into UX strategist. The way I classify this is the strategist is the person who, I hate this phrase, change agent. I don't.
It feels like disruptor. Like it's, that same level of buzz.
I hate that phrase, change agent. The idea is UX strategist drives change. Strategy is all about, you know, positioning yourself. It's all about finding advantage. To me, a UX strategist is that person who figures out, from the information the researcher gives them and other things, they are helping product managers and product designers identify the opportunities for the business. And then how do we align that with what our business strategy is and, you know, what the user expectations are for our company?
Yeah, I think that's to a good degree how I think about a design strategist in the realm of user experience design. I think I like to think of it as they're sort of the folks who act as a compass for navigating that big picture or that future. If it's looking like it could be fruitful, right?
Yeah, I like that a lot.
So they're very much involved in the explorative environments in businesses, and they're there to work with your head of products and your C-suite and your design team.
And there's somebody that the communication piece is going to factor in very heavily, because they need to know how to take this information the researchers are giving them and have it make sense to the business strategy.
Sure.
And that can be very, you know, that can go through many layers before it gets to those people. And so articulating that well and helping people understand that can be incredibly valuable.
Yeah, they leverage too, I think. Just generally speaking, if you're in the room with several different perspectives in the business, they're able to leverage the user side of things in terms of what's the strategy plan going to be.
From there, design architects. This is one I call the maestro. A UX design architect is somebody that I think of as the person who conducts the concert, right? They're helping, especially when we get into talking about visual designers and information architects. They're the person who is really keeping all of these things in sort of a lockstep. Or as a physical architect, they're the person who knows how to make the building and make it in a way that can be actually built.
I it's funny you mentioned like a musical analogy, because I often arrive at analogies in music when I'm talking about product design. They're often the kind of designer who's able to deliver sort of original concepts in a way that they articulate it to a wide audience. And that synchronization that you're talking about, sort of like the orchestrator, if you will, they're able to structure that in a way that makes sense both to the product or the service, but also to the business, and make it a bit more concrete.
Could you elaborate how, I don't mean to sneak preview the next one, but the way that you describe design architect makes you think of product designer.
That's why I was saying funny that you mentioned the music analogy, because that is very much an overlap. I think when I think of architects just generally in the UX space, their focus tends to be more on overall literal function, if you will. Whereas a product designer, while I as a product designer care very much about how things are functioning in the work that we're doing, I spend most of my time more in the subjective up top and more of a higher level, having to overview and oversee what's going on from front to back, I guess.
I think of a guy like Frank Lloyd Wright a lot in this sort of a silo, because, you know, he was somebody, you know, revolutionary in the, you know, physical structure architecture realm. And, you know, he designed houses that pushed boundaries and innovated in a lot of different areas. And you can look at his houses today and think, I'm impressed that that thing is still standing, because he understood the big picture when he would design those things. And he knew that if I bring in these people and these resources, we can make this house, was it a waterfall? Is waterfall? Falling water. That's what it is. Is one of those houses that it's like, it shouldn't be, but he knew how to do it and he was able to pull it off. Hmm. And that's where I think about something like a UX architect. Hmm. So you mentioned product designer. So this is the next one in my list here. So the way I phrased it was, you know, the product designer is likely to create or oversee journey maps, wireframes, prototypes, and even system design. I really hate the way I write notes sometimes.
if you're taking, say, a lot of synthesized findings from a researcher and you're working with a strategist to infuse those into the business, I kind of, again, see the architect in a planning state being able to infuse that into the blueprint of what we might build and work with UX designers and product designers to see that out, which could be wrong, which could be totally wrong, by the way. That's just as are most, you know, labels and titles. Why did I even make an attempt at a tool, right?
So your title is product designer. What would you view your responsibilities as a product designer? What does that encompass for you, Patrick?
I will preface this with, I work at a particular company that sees product design as something that another company may not. Sure. So it does depend on where you're at. But product design, I view as more of a holistic approach to building something from start to finish and beyond that hopefully serves a need. As a product designer, in my role, I'm at the intersection of a lot of disciplines. I need to have like the wherewithal and overarching perspective on a problem space to the degree that I can work towards a solution, both at the ground level and also at a higher level. And to go back to the music analogy, I do find myself in a position where I feel like I'm a player of an instrument who is keenly interested and understands the orchestra as a whole. So I have my hand in the intricacies of the work, but I'm also constantly aware of the full piece and its meaning, if that makes any sense.
You know the melody.
Okay.
Right. And I do think too, and I don't know if this is true elsewhere, but a lot of my job is in making sense of several perspectives that are inbound about an idea. Alignment of teams and their perspectives, and alignment of three facets that I'm always having to keep track of in my head, which is the business, the user, and opportunity. So defining a problem, making something to solve it, and validating the solution in the real world is sort of like the baseline that I would say that I'm involved in.
From product design, we get into visual design. Now, visual design can be, I think, frequently confused with simply graphic design. It is. It's a square is a rectangle, but a rectangle isn't always a square, right? There's overlap, and there's a lot of overlap, but visual design tends to focus heavily on, you'll hear phrases like visual communication or visual language.
Okay.
And it generally will apply only in the design or the digital space. Graphic design could be in a magazine. Graphic design could be on a billboard. Graphic design could be in a flyer. Visual design is on a website.
The duty, I guess, as a visual designer, perhaps being to effectively design to influence or garner a reaction from users that are engaging in a product or service. Graphic design, yes. I mean, the fundamental principles of graphic design do overlap very much with just the entire realm of visual design, as does what one might call and what I went to school for, which is communication design, because you communicate visually as well. So visual design in the space of user experience design has a lot to do with the point of engagement, the point of stimulation, the point of representation of an idea or a brand or an identity or a system of components across the entire suite of tools or products or services in a seamless and cohesive manner, if that makes any sense.
A lot of overlap and a lot of shared value between them. The next two are very closely related, at least in relation to each other, which is information architecture and UX writing.
Yeah, I think you talked about IA a bit in earlier in the show.
Yeah, so if you are an information architect, you're generally tied into organizing the stuff of your website and figuring out, like, a lot of the times people will think, well, IA is just navigation. And I had mentioned earlier, IA goes beyond that. It's the overall structure of your site. And the thing I like to use is the idea that it builds scent for your website.
Scent? Like smelling scents?
Yeah, because think about when you go into Google Analytics and you look at landing pages on your site. Obviously, the home page is a major landing page, but people land elsewhere on your site. And if they're looking for other information, does that landing page give them a scent to know where they are?
Oh, that's really interesting.
On the map of your site.
I too was like, what exactly would that mean? But yeah, I guess that does make sense.
It's the argument that it comes back to is something that goes back about 12 years, I think, at this point, 10 years. A debate I had with Jared Spool about breadcrumbs and the value of breadcrumbs, because they take up space. They take up physical space on your web page. His data showed that nobody used them. Nobody clicks on breadcrumbs as a tool. My argument was they provided scent to the user to understand where they were within the confines of your site. Hmm. And how do you measure? Like, that's a hard thing to measure. But that's part of what information architecture is all about. And an architect comes in and thinks about, okay, if you landed on the computer science degree, does that scent provide you the information if you want to go over and look into, you know, an MBA, for instance, because it was in the College of Business in this case? Probably not. And so you think about how these things interconnect and intertwine, so that users can get from point A to point B, regardless of where they land. Patrick, I think you said you used the analogy of a compass.
Earlier when we were talking about it, yes.
Yeah, that I think rings very true, right? It's the same. It's a different way of saying scent, right? You need that true north to kind of figure out where you're going on a site. That's what IA does in the confines of UX.
And it's worth, I think, just noting that there's an entire plethora of exercises behind that too, right? To make sense and organize information just generally, to structure it in a way that makes better sense to an experience you're trying to provide.
Yeah.
I think Krug calls that the trunk test, right? Like if someone kidnapped you and threw you in the trunk of a car and dropped off in the middle of the website, could you find your way to... The analogy kind of breaks down there.
But. Yeah, no, that I think that's right. It was a test on navigability, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
The last part of that, so I mentioned UX writing. A UX writer is somebody, think about it, there's a really easy way to sort of divide this, right? Your blog is not ran by a UX writer, but the little pieces of information that exist within an application can be driven by a UX writer. Copywriters will deal with long form.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting...
Writing it's an for it's, you like UI and UX elements.
Yeah. So I was going to mention, like, there's a lot of overlap, I think, too, with just generally the practice or not, well, the profession of a UI designer. They often, I think, whether they like it or not, are involved in a lot of the language that's found in the interfaces that they're designing for. I just was going through a small challenge with some developers today on exactly this topic, where we had a list of items, and each line item had the ability to be saved or shared. And if it were saved, it would go into a grander list. And this has to do with the context of saved searches and search history and what have you. And when you're in that saved list, he had said, okay, well, I mentioned we have to have perhaps a way to eliminate that saved line item or remove it. And so they prototyped it with the term unsave, which to me rings like, well, who, first of all, who uses that term unsave? Secondly, does, regardless of my perspective on it, does it ring true to the people who are using the product? And what we found was it doesn't. That was our hypothesis. But also the value in focusing on something as simple as whether the word unsave makes sense is, in the future, say the context of a saved search query is actually reframed as a favorite. So are you unsaving a favorite or are you unfavoriting at that point? So we arrived at the terminology remove, which is right, broadly applicable to several different instances of that interfacial experience.
We had a similar issue come up with an open source project that I work on, where there was the question of when you're soft deleting a record, what is the verb to use for that? Because like you want to communicate to the user, this isn't going to be deleted forever, but at the same time, also, like, this is kind of a destructive change and you should be careful. I think we settled on deactivate for this one. And then for a different one, we used archive. And it's very contextual, but I get what you mean by the difference between like a copywriter and a UX writer. Very different goals.
The phrase, if you want to Google it and get some articles on it, is micro copy.
That I'm familiar with. Yeah,
that's one that will ring true with a lot of people. It's like these little blurbs, 5-6 words here and there that help you understand interfaces and interface design.
I know that you didn't intentionally order these in any particular way, but I like that the first item is UX generalist, where the firm might have one person doing everything, and the last one is UX writer, which is the person responsible for doing microcopy
doing the micro, like, yeah,
components.
Micro,
yeah, like,
micro.
Like when we talk about like how much budget a department might have for various tasks to like allocate a specific specialist.
Yeah.
Like this is definitely on the opposite side of the spectrum from a generalist.
Yep. And this is like, it's a crazy conversation because it's just so extensive and almost exhausting to have to categorize, and businesses love to do this. They like to categorize based on what their perceived skill set is and slap a label on it and then make teams out of it. And that's why I encourage thinking of UX design as a process. And as a team, you have particular values, particular strengths, and particular weaknesses. And you're looking at where are those crevices and voids in your team, and those values that certain people might bring to the UX process might fill that. And that's the way I look at it.
So the last area of all of this comes down to, okay, so here's what UX is, here's what some titles are, what do you do about it? How do you hone these skills? How do you expand these skills? First and foremost, I want to say, figure out which broad skill set applies to you. We mentioned a bunch of these at the start of the show. Are you a research nerd? Or do you like communication? Do you love running tests? Or do you like making something? Figure out like which one of those things appeals the most to you. One incredible resource, and I literally, as I was researching this episode, I noticed this feature. If you go to uxmatters.com, they're one of the resources we'll mention again here momentarily. They've got this background that looks like a little grid of UX titles. In the upper right corner, if you click a button, there's a button that says View Infographic. It brings their background to the foreground, and it has all of these interconnected bubbles of research and design and strategy and development, and it shows you how different skills kind of connect and overlap. And that, to me, was super cool, and it helps you understand, like, the person who does your information architecture doesn't necessarily have a lot of overlap with the people doing A/B testing. But if you are doing design and product strategy, those can be two different roles, but they're also very closely related. So that can help you figure out if you look at, think about what your passion is, what interests you, and see what it connects to within those bubbles. I think that's kind of a good way to go and dig in a little bit, at least to figure out where you should branch out to if you want to broaden your horizons, so to speak.
Oh, really, really quick point. I think there's probably a depth that someone who wants to get into UX should spelunk to in each of those areas, even if they ultimately choose just a very narrow set to really specialize in. Just a guess.
Yeah. I think that's probably right. Yeah.
Yeah.
The two things that strike me from looking at this right now is how accessibility is out on its own lone island.
Yeah, I don't love that. I'm going to say
I don't love that either. And I was like, okay, where is the design and where's the development? Oh, it's everywhere. So we couldn't put accessibility everywhere. We had to put it on a lone island. And the other thing is like the form that this takes on insinuated to me the idea that out of any one of these could grow a bridge or a new, what I'll call, molecule or something. So it is, it does give you a sense of the organic nature of the entire landscape.
Yeah. The second thing you should do, read. I can't emphasize this enough. There are four websites I'll recommend to you right now. They're all easy because they all start with the name UX for some reason, because whatever reason, I guess Google likes the keyword UX. And if you go to the show notes, I think we've got sites from literally every one of these in the show notes. UX Booth, UX Planet, UX Collective, UX Matters. All of these put out content that can help you understand any and or all of these facets of this whole realm. So you can start to figure out what makes sense to you, what doesn't, what you like and what you don't like, and what you think you're good at versus what you think you need to learn more about.
I could throw a few more out there if you want.
Oh, yeah, do it.
UX Booth, UXdesign.cc. Envision runs a series of talks that you could catch up on. Trends.UXdesign.cc, InteractionDesign.org. And of course, a go-to for me is, and it's a little bit more broad and conceptual, but the 99% Invisible podcast.
Oh, yeah.
And A List Apart. A List Apart's always pretty fundamentally sound.
99% Invisible is a good plug because I enjoy the hell out of that because it does get very broad in concept. If those went by too fast for anybody, don't worry. I'll go back through when I'm editing and I will add links to every one of those in the show notes. There's also a lot of online training out there. Now, these are less official. There are some certifications you can go get. Do it if you want to. They're expensive as shit. A lot of them range from, you know, literally thousands to like $10,000, $12,000, $15,000. Don't advocate for that for a lot of people because it's out of your budget. But there's online training that you can go look at that's got a lower barrier to entry. Udemy's got a really good course that we'll have linked. Pluralsight, I know this episode is airing about mid-April. You only have about 2 weeks left to take advantage of it, but Pluralsight's offering all their courses free to folks during the whole COVID-19 lockdown. Go check them out. And not to plug our stuff, but thegymnasium.com, we've got two or three different really good UX courses you can take. They are free, no strings attached ever, and there are a lot of those resources out there that you can go and learn some of these concepts, even if you're just starting out and really want to learn the basics and all of this entry-level stuff. Those are all really great ways to get started in that. Folks, Stick with us. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, and then we will get you on to your next show that you're hopefully going to listen to that maybe will be 99% invisible. I don't know. The Drunken UX Podcast is brought to you by our friends at NewCloud. NewCloud is an industry-leading interactive map provider who has been building location-based solutions for organizations for a decade. Are you trying to find a simple solution to provide your users with an interactive map of your school, city, or business? Well, NewCloud's interactive map platform gives you the power to make and edit a custom interactive map in just minutes. They have a team of professional cartographers who specialize in map illustrations of many different styles and are ready to design an artistic rendering to fit your exact needs. One map serves all of your users' devices with responsive maps that are designed to scale and blend in seamlessly with your existing website. To request a demonstration or to view their portfolio, visit them online at newcloud.com/drunkenux. That's nucloud.com/drunkenux. Patrick, man, thanks for coming on with us tonight. We appreciate it and digging into all these things. This is such a deep well. Again, the show notes will be open to everybody. Crazy. There's a ton of information there. But take the microphone for a couple minutes. Tell people where they can find you, what you got going on, or anything at all that they want you to know or that you want them to know. I'm still making stuff backwards.
Well, I guess first and foremost, I think my primary outlet is Twitter. So you can find me on Twitter at, I'm going to spell this out for you, Michael.
Okay, thanks.
At P. Brannigan, P-B-R-A-N-I-G-A-N.
I feel like there's like four too few R's in that.
That's where I'm at. I hope I spelled that right. You can find the majority of my commentary on just about anything, mostly design and gaming, to be quite frank, there. But yeah,
gaming, like video gaming or like board gaming or game design,
video games. I've been dabbling in some indie game development for the past year, plug to Godot Engine. And, yeah, that's where I would say that's where, if you want to find out more about me. Otherwise, as Michael mentioned, I'm over at Aquint, and, we are, in fact, hiring designers right now, so a senior UX designer role is open. Feel free to reach out to me for that. Other than that, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you, sir.
So if you want to connect with us on the socials, we are Drunken UX on Facebook and Twitter, and you can come chat with us now at drunkenux.com/discord, and you can see all of Michael's wonderful UX memes on Instagram.com /drunkenuxpodcast. It's good.
DevOps,
no, dude, the
it's a whole range.
They're quality.
I did want to say one last thing.
Go for it.
There were a lot of titles and labels mentioned in this podcast. The first thing you want to do if you're trying to get into this world is throw all of them out the window. Don't worry about them.
Yeah.
I'm serious. Don't worry about them.
And yeah, they will change and evolve. And I think if there's one piece of advice I can give anybody, it's just to roll with that and understand that you need to grow and evolve and change. Keep reading.
Was that a bet or a dare to say something?
No, I'm laughing because he said the one piece of advice I have to give you, and then he didn't say what I thought he was going to say.
What did you think I was going to say? Something. The only thing I have left to say is something stupid like, hey, folks, keep your personas close, but your users closer. Bye-bye.